Hello, I'm Ross Kamich, and welcome to How This Is Building Me, a podcast focused on the highs and lows, ups and downs of all those involved with cancer, cancer medicine, and cancer science. And one of the fun things about this podcast is I get to interview people who I both like, and interesting on top of both of those lists is Dr. Mary Redman. Mary, would you care to introduce yourself in any way you see fit?
Hi, Ross. Great to be here. So introducing myself in any way fit, it's a hard thing to choose. I happen to be a biostatistician doing cancer research, but I also just somebody who have lots and lots of interests. So if you want to hang out with me on a ski hill or going skiing or cycling or anything like that, I'll also talk about statistics with you.
There you go. Yeah. Well, where should we start? Okay. Statistics. Okay. We'll get there, but go on. Let's tempt the audience. What is statistics?
Statistics is a way to quantify variability.
Yeah, that's so clear.
I know. I thought you would say that. I kind of wanted to stop right there.
Yeah. So
I mean,
Your turn.
Your turn. Well, so, I mean, you quantify information all the time, but nothing's perfect. And so statistics is a way to assess the quality and type of information that you have and how reliable it is.
Okay. So how does Mary Redman become a statistician? Because you weren't born one. Your parents statisticians?
No. But my dad's has always been a mathematician. And I was the kid in grade school that, like, if you had a math competition and you didn't have me on your team, you were going to lose. So I know, right? I've always been good at math. It's always been something that I enjoyed. You know, we'd go on trips as a family, and my dad and I would be calculating how long it was going to take us to get there, given how fast we were going and how many miles we had left, or for driving to Canada, converting between miles and kilometers, or converting between Celsius and Fahrenheit. I mean,
what did your dad do for a living?
He basically computer science. It had been a field when he was going through school. He would have been a computer scientist, but he developed information systems.
And for, like, in academia or for in commercial?
Commercial. So, I mean, he had his own business for a while, and then he worked for a manufacturing company that built big machinery like tree chippers and debarkers and the machines that align parts of planes and things like that.
Oh, so accuracy is pretty good. Or is that precision? Hold on. What's the...
Yes, I think precision is what you want.
Yeah, we got it. Yeah. You want both if it's a tree chipper.
Yeah.
And you have a twin sister, not identical, but a twin sister.
Yes. My sister, Karen, she's 4 minutes older than me. She's blonde hair, blue-eyed, a little bit taller than me, very shy and quiet, and studied art.
So given that this is an audio recording, they have no idea if you're a blonde-haired, blue-eyed, and how tall you are. You introduced it. Go on.
Yeah, I'm a redhead with hazel eyes. I'm also not very tall, but...
And can we be precise and accurate in your description of your height?
I'm 5 feet tall, exactly.
There you go. That's exactly. It's perfect. You've got an artistic sister. What did your mom do?
My mom is now retired, but she was an elementary school teacher. And she also is probably one of the most amazing quilters you've ever seen. So very artistically talented. And she's always had a beautiful garden. And
you guys all grew up in Pacific Northwest?
Yes. Well, I mean, my mom is from Seattle. My sister and I were born in Seattle. My dad grew up in Southern Illinois and moved out to Seattle in 1966 to work for Boeing after I graduated college.
Wonder how big Seattle was then.
Not. And actually not, I don't know if you heard about this, but in the late 60s, early 70s when Boeing had a major sell-off? I mean, so there was actually a billboard that said, will the last person who leaves Seattle turn off the light?
Wow.
It was, I mean, like, because Boeing was a major employer. And so my dad actually was working on something for the defense side. And so his project wasn't cut, but he didn't get laid off. But Boeing was really a big employer at the time.
Okay. So, and you've never left Seattle because you have, you know, no sense of adventurous spirit at all.
Yeah, you've met me, so you know that I have no sense of adventuresome spirit. So yeah, I've stayed here.
And yeah, I've always asked you about this one, but it's my favorite thing, because I think Seattle is one of my favorite places. But I remember reading that it's not very friendly, which is the complete opposite of you, because you're just like pathologically friendly.
Yeah, I'd stand out even. Yeah, Seattle, it's nice, but not friendly. So people are like, nobody's going to be rude, but people aren't going to just necessarily have conversation. Like, I mean, I'm standing in the line at the grocery store and I talk to everybody. And sometimes people look at me like I'm weird.
I mean, I'm British, where, you know, nobody talks to anybody, or if they do, they just, you know, they look at you as if like, well, why are you talking to me? What do you want?
The neighborhood I live in is called Ballard, which maybe that gives you a hint as to who like settled in Seattle, but it's Scandinavian. We still have the Norwegian Independence Day parade in Seattle and Ballard, and it's the largest parade outside of Norway.
I think you told me that, aren't you a quarter Norwegian?
I am a quarter Norwegian.
Is that where the red hair comes from?
Yes, it is. My great-grandparents moved from Norway to North Dakota, and that's where my mom's mom grew up.
Okay, so we've established, you know, the Redmond family.
Yes.
You know, this interesting mix. And you're the math whiz at school. But, you know, most people then don't go, yeah, but I'm going to do math at university. But
except I did. So, so my dad's undergraduate degree was in math and physics. So I had the model of you could be a math major. And so I started out undergrad thinking I was going to go into engineering.
This is at UW.
This is in the University of Washington. Yes.
Yeah.
UW. You said that right. That's good.
Yeah. Well, you've trained me.
Good.
Yeah.
You've listened.
Okay. So you're a math major at
Yes.
UW.
Yes. And my sophomore year, I was sharing an apartment with three other girls. And one of the women I was living with, her parents were both medical doctors. One was a pathologist, one was a urologist. And they lived just outside of Seattle in a neighborhood called, on Mercer Island. And so we were over for dinner at her parents' house. And I'm talking with her mother, who pathologist, but also did research in HPV and HIV. And had worked with biostatisticians, and she heard that I would like studying mathematics. I was actually working in a bioengineering lab. A friend of mine from high school's father had employed me to work in his lab. And she said, you should be a biostatistician. And I thought, what's a biostatistician? And so I went to the University of Washington Department of Biostatistics webpage, and it described what a biostatistician is. You know, you get to use your mathematical skills to contribute to research and learn about all kinds of different things. And it sounded great.
So where were you during your math degree when this epiphany happened?
I was like, it was like my sophomore, junior year. Pretty early on, I had a path.
Did that change how you viewed your last few years in the math degree?
Well, so in math, what you could do is you could do either pure math or you could do math with an area of concentration. And so what I did was an area of concentration and probability theory.
Okay. And would you like to explain that one to the audience? Because, I mean, one of the things I love most about you is that you're actually, you break the mold of the mathematician, statistician who is, you know, when I was a PhD student, they used to call these people deep sea fish. They would sort of live in the basement and look like, and sort of blink if they sort of encountered light. Whereas you are articulate and sociable, which is an amazing combination.
So, I mean, statistics is about, you know, you collect information and you try to quantify that. Probability theory is, we basically talk about different models. Like you can assume that, like we've all heard of the bell curve, right?
Okay.
And the bell curve is the normal probability distribution. And what that means is that if you have a continuous variable that has no constraints on what values it can take on, so it can be, you know, minus infinity to plus infinity, and you want to describe the distribution, a lot of the time it's symmetrically distributed. And so you have that bell curve, and the top of the curve is the mean. And then how variable, like how much the values can range, like is how either narrow that curve is or how wide that curve is. And then you quantify that variability by like standard error, standard deviation. And so we oftentimes assume that when you have a continuous variable that it follows the normal distribution. We have other models that have been described to describe other types of things, like when you have count data, like, you know, you have your white blood cell counts, you know that blood cell counts can't be negative. And so the normal distribution doesn't necessarily make sense there. And we use something else called a Poisson distribution. And there have been ways that these different distributions that quantify how information is distributed. And within those distributions, there are properties that define the mean and the variance and other things like that. And so when you can use those models, then you can say, take that model to apply to a piece of information about what you're trying to learn. Probability theory could even describe, so you're playing poker and you get a certain hand, what's the probability that you're going to get a certain, like if you exchange a card, what that you're going to get a card that's going to complete the hand in a certain way. It's instead of you have data, it's the more in the potential, like if you're moving forward in the world and trying to think about how what the chances of something happening are, what the distribution, like the values could be, that's what you use probability theory for.
Does that impact you in the real world? I mean, do you sit there and calculate probabilities of things when you make decisions, or are you more, you know, oh, this feels about right?
I think that my mathematical training and statistics training has totally shaped how I just tend to approach things in general. I do very much approach, it's like I look at, you know, I'm driving down the street and I see something and I'm like, okay, well, here are these things coming into play. What are the chances of certain things happening? I don't just kind of go, wee, you know, I do think it's a way of logic.
All right. So you go, okay. So you had your epiphany moment. Yep. The pathologist says, you know, the perfect confluence of all of your skills is biostatistics.
Yeah.
You're trundling through the end of your math degree at UW, and then what do you do?
So I'm finishing up my math degree. I actually took a little extra time because there was a stochastic processes class that I really wanted to take from a professor who was really incredible. And
I totally understand that. I would have gone for the stochastic processes too.
I thought so. Ron Pike was the professor, but he actually got us. We talked about the Black-Scholes equation, which they use in financial calculus, you know, like the whole finance side of math that I'm not interested in. But Black-Scholes equation is how they quantify, you know, when you look at the stock market, you think that's Brownian motion, hopefully with drift, and you want it to be drifting upward, and how you, all the math behind all of that. So
really?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many things. So I'm finishing up and I'm looking at thinking about biostatistics. And I also learned that, I mean, as I was finishing, I kept meeting people that were biostatisticians or talking to other people. And I learned that the University of Washington Department of Biostatistics was one of the best programs in the country. And also the friend's mom who said you should be a biostatistician, she also said to me, if you get into the UW, I'll hire you as a research assistant. So I did, which most people are not recommended to do, and I applied to one program. And so
That overconfidence, like, you know, these people will take me. It's one of the best in the country. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, or it's more just showing my 20-something-year-old self that it's like, you know, that you just figure things are going to work out. Yeah. I mean, so of course, we've talked about this before. I'm not like really great with deadlines, or I'm really good at meeting deadlines at the deadline. So I'm not an early person. So I barely scheduled doing my GRE in time, but I did it. And then that went well. I got my letters of recommendation. Of course, like one didn't get sent right away. So I'm like on the deadline of the applications. I'm calling people and they're faxing it or whatever to the department. And so I got everything in, and then I learned not long ago. Because the good thing about being close to the deadline is that you find out the news really quickly.
Yes, relatively speaking. There isn't a lead time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I found out like a week or two later that I got in.
Yeah, I mean, obviously they went, this person obviously should come to our program. Why do we even discuss it? You know.
So yeah, that's how that worked.
and at that point in time, what are you enrolling in? Is it a PhD program, or you don't know it's a PhD at that point? It's just a master's program.
I'd entered in as master's. I was just thinking I would get a master's degree, but there were people who had enrolled to get into the PhD program. So when I started, University of Washington starts classes in like late September. So when we started, there were 19 people in my class. I think maybe half for PhD and half for master's students. A few people came in with master's degrees already, but most of us were just coming in straight from undergrad.
Do you have to have a master's degree to get a PhD, or you can go straight into the PhD?
You can go straight into the PhD, but the way that it worked, at least at UW, was that you could either do a thesis for your master's degree, or you could, after the first year, we had to take a stat theory course that was for everybody, both master's and PhD students, and you had to pass that. And then your second year plus, you had to take we had two exams, the applied exam that was given a data set, analyze it, write up a report, justify it, and then you had to be interviewed on it. And so you got graded on that. And then there was a theory exam that was based on our second year stat theory courses, and you had to pass that. So once you passed your applied and theory exams, you could then get a non-thesis master's.
Okay. So master's was 2 years?
About. Yeah.
And at what point did you decide that what was missing in your life was a PhD?
At the end of the first year, when I thought, wow, 2 years of courses, I'm not going to know enough. And then the other side of me was like, well, if those people can get a PhD, so can I. So.
And then how long did the whole thing take?
How long did the PhD take?
Yeah.
7 years or something.
Is that including the 2 years of the master or on
yeah,
top of
yeah.
that?
No, yeah. I started grad school in September of 97, and I finished in like April of 2004.
And I think we were joking about this, that generally speaking, a PhD is this sort of, you're grateful for it when you look back on it. And it's this kind of, it's a bit like running a marathon.
Yes.
You know, it's like it's really horrible at the time and then you're glad that you've done it.
Except that the marathon, it'd be like, well, it could be 20 miles, but it could be 35 miles. And you're not going to know. Like, you just have to keep running, and then at some point you're going to be done, but you don't know when you're going to be done. And while you're doing it, people ask you, when are you going to be done? And you basically just say, I have no idea.
So how do you know when to finish? So it's different in Britain. In Britain, it's like 3 years, and then your funding runs out, and you have to write it up in 3 years. I took 4 years because I was an idiot, but somehow I got funding for an extra year. But yeah, in the US, it's this open-ended.
Yeah.
You know, it's like life without parole.
Yeah. So, and I mean, which is why you had to, it's like best if you are hanging out only with other grad students getting PhDs, because then everybody understands your situation. So after, let's see, usually people took about 3 years of classes, and somewhere in the third year, they found an advisor and started working on their dissertation topic. Somewhere along there, because it's biostatistics, we also had to do what they called a biology exam, where you spent like 6 weeks researching some area, and then you had to give a presentation showing an ability to have a depth of understanding of some biologic area. I did mine on HPV and the cell cycle control and how HPV disrupts that so that you can end up with getting cancer.
Was that linked to your friend's mother, who was a pathologist who worked on HPV?
Yeah. Exactly, because the first 4 years I was in grad school, I worked with her group.
And was that, but she paid you as a research assistant too?
Yeah, so basically, yeah, and the RA ship, I mean, they paid for your tuition, you got a stipend to live off of, and you got medical dental vision.
What?
So,
sounds pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah, and I got that, I mean, so I left grad school with no debt. I mean, I didn't make very much, but I also had no debt.
Were you living on your own, or were you living with your parents?
No, I was living on my own.
Okay. Or maybe with those three other people that you were staying.
Yeah, I mean, very. I had lived with roommates sometimes, or lived on my own. So then you had to do this biology exam, and then once you had your dissertation topic, you formed your committee, and then the first thing you did, probably you had to do this too, is a general exam, which was basically you had to present your plan for your dissertation. Did you have to do this?
No. In Britain, it's kind of like, here's a bench, go discover something. If you're still alive in 3 years' time, we'll tell you if you passed.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, so we did our general examination, and once you passed your general exam, that's when you became a PhD candidate. So, which had like PhD.C. Yeah. And the general idea was that, you know, you could write a dissertation which could have been the equivalent of, say, 3 papers.
Yeah.
And most of the time, I think that when the general exam happens, the committees actually will tell people that they have too much on their plate. They're trying to do too much, because the idea is that you're not going to have everything done when you finish, right? You have to have something that you keep doing. So I did my general exam. It must have been sometime in my third year. Maybe it was my... No, it must have been my third year. It's too long ago. But somewhere shortly after that, my advisor left the University of Washington, and she actually went down to UCLA. So I kind of was working a little bit on my own for the last few years. And
because you stayed in Seattle.
Yeah, I did. Well, because, I mean, I was a student at UW. I mean, so.
So what was that kind of like, was that, hooray, you know, I can do what I want to do now? Or was that like, you know, I'm all on my own?
It was more, looking back, I think that the department sort of failed me. That, you know, I mean, when you're a student, you know, you've never done a dissertation before. You don't know anything. You don't know a lot. And they should have set up something where I was, or encouraged me to meet with somebody on a regular basis or something where I had some in-person time or add some structure. But that didn't happen. So I would kind of work on my own, and then I would like upload my dissertation draft so that my advisor could download it, and she'd print it out, and then she'd write things on it and fax it back to me. So
that sounds stressful.
It was very stressful.
To go back to the idea of like the marathon with no end, did you say, okay, now I'm ready to submit, or did your supervisor, who's now in a different state, sort of say, okay, you're good to go, or had that happen?
I think that we kind of got to where it was, you know, that because there was the plan out of the general exam, so I knew what I needed to be working on. So I think that we kind of came to where it's, okay, we're good. We're to a place to submit. But so then you schedule your final examination, and to schedule your final exam, yes, you have to submit a form to the graduate school. You can't schedule it less than 30 days from when you're submitting this form. Everybody has to sign off. Your reading committee is supposed to all have read the dissertation, which mine did not. And then you schedule it. So all of that kind of had to happen. And, you know, there's a time thing where everybody else is like finishing too from my class. But I don't remember how much guidance I got, honestly.
I think you told me that, contrary to popular belief, your class was very heavily female-dominated?
Yeah, we were 19 people, and there were only 4 guys. And 2 of those guys dropped out in the first year.
Oh, losers.
I know, right?
And my favorite thing is that, you know, of the 4 guys, you dated at least one of them. But
I did. I only dated one of them.
Yeah, you did, because the statistics were in your favor. I don't know, I'm just going to get over that incredibly funny joke I just delivered there.
You're gonna see me at a meeting or something and make a joke. It'll just be this continued joke you have with yourself. So
yeah, I do. I just, you know, I'll just crack myself up. And okay, so you do. So let me get this right. Okay, so I'm painting a picture here. Born in Seattle, brought up in Seattle, go to UW for undergraduate, master's, PhD, and then what do you do at the end of the PhD? Where do you go?
I mean, the University of Washington, the biostatistics department is in the health sciences building, and the biostatistics department is in the H wing. And then I went and did my postdoc in the School of Dentistry, which is also in the health sciences building, but I think it's like in the J wing or something. So it was really far away.
Yeah, I can tell that. But you haven't got to the point. Where's your first job? Oh, is there a postdoc? Sorry, did you just go straight from
postdoc
PhD? That was a postdoc. Okay.
Yeah. And then I was finishing up my first year or so at postdoc. And
what was it? Hold on. What was the postdoc on in the dentistry school?
Yeah, I was just working on my own stuff. Like I was applying my work, my research area to teeth.
Can you expand on that?
It's sort of like a blip in my history. It was basically the professor that I was going to work with was just like a smart, nice guy. And finishing my PhD was very stressful. And I just needed something that was calm and nice and not a big change. So
you worked on teeth.
I worked on teeth because they're correlated, you know, so it was kind of I was working in causal inference. So my dissertation was on estimating causal effects from observational data. So, you know, non-randomized studies. And there are all these assumptions you have to employ, but there are different methods you can use. But normally with most of the most approaches that we use, you assume that each individual unit in your study, be it a person, is independent. So you can make inferences without concern about any type of correlation structure, but teeth are definitely related. So
they talk to each other.
They do. So it was just kind of a neat expansion of thinking about that problem.
And then what happened? A year of calm water. And I totally get that. I do think a PhD is the most traumatic period in most people's lives for those people who do them. And then what changed after a year?
Postdoc is typically only about 2 years. So I knew I was going to have to start looking for a real job. And there was a job that came up, faculty position at Fred Hutch, the cancer center here in Seattle. And I applied for it. And it was
Did you apply at the last minute?
No, I actually applied as soon as I learned about it. Like it had been posted for a while. So they'd already interviewed a few people.
But they hadn't interviewed you.
They hadn't. No, actually. So I think, if I remember the numbers, they had 55 applicants. They interviewed 6 people. I think I was the last person they interviewed.
And they told you straight away, boom, you're the one.
They did actually tell me pretty quickly.
It's so sickening. All right. So expanding your CV to include another place in Seattle.
Yeah.
You then started there. Hold on, when was that? 2005? Yeah. That was the same year I arrived in America.
See, you know.
We're in parallel paths. And what
things happen to both of us at the same time.
I know. So, okay, so you're now an assistant professor in biostatistics? Is that your title?
No, the Fred Hutch is divided into divisions. And so I was in the public health sciences division at Fred Hutch.
And I don't want to be a spoiler here, but was the Fred Hutch Cancer Center, the position, was it immediately associated with one of the cooperative groups or that came later?
Immediately. The job opening was to work with SWOG.
Okay, so let's explain what SWOG is.
SWOG used to mean something. It used to stand for the Southwest Oncology Group. Now
it still stands for that.
No,
it's just, it doesn't? What does it stand for?
It's just SWOG, you know. It's the SWOG Cancer Research Network.
And there's no periods between the letters. It's just one word. SWOG is a word.
One word. It's just, SWOG is a word. So it's one of the adult oncology network groups that are funded by the National Cancer Institute to conduct clinical trials in the United States. And there used to be 10 of them, and now there's 4 adult groups, and there's 1 children's group. And it used to be based in the Southwest. Like the group chair was in San Antonio. The statistical center was at MD Anderson. So all of it, and the institutions that enrolled patients tend to be Southwest. So you had Southwestern Oncology Group, you had the Eastern Cooperative Group, you had the North NCCTG. I don't even remember all of the acronyms. They're all acronyms. So, but then as time went along, it became that the groups were really just pan country, and that you had, the group chair when I joined had been the group chair for 20 years or something, and he was based in Texas. But in 2006, there was a new group chair to Swag, and he was at University of Michigan. And the Statistical Center came to Seattle in the, was it the 80s or the 90s? And basically, it was up for competition, and the person who established the Statistical Center in Seattle, I mean, he brought it from, it was at MD Anderson, I think, and they lost it because they were not doing a very good job. And they were kind of pissed off. So they're like, all of the, like the forms and everything, the data was all in file cabinets. And so I don't know whether 40 file cabinets or something, when they sent them up, they didn't label the keys.
It's like, that's a passive aggressive thing.
So yeah. So then, I mean, then it just became, so that's why SWOG doesn't mean anything other than, because you've got the statistical centers in Seattle. Now the group chairs in Oregon, you know, but there's an office in Michigan, and then there's people in San Antonio, and yeah.
So when you joined SWOG,
mm-hmm.
and then, so you're at Fred Hutch, but you're really at SWOG. Is what it?
I mean, just like, I mean, so I'm a faculty member. I mean, the Hutch has over times has decided how much. I mean, when I first started, they guaranteed that they cover 25% of your salary. They lowered it down to 20 at one point. They're actually trying to go back up right now. So right now, the center will cover up to 45% of my salary. I usually don't take that much salary support, but otherwise, like most people, I'm responsible for covering my salary and grants. It just happens to be that my biggest project and most of my funding is from SWOG.
And then did you go straight into the lung program, which is where we met?
Yes. So when I joined, I mean, they weren't completely certain which group I was going to go into. But one thing they mentioned is that I had shown an ability to work with challenging personalities. And so, you know, the lung group. So.
Yeah, I love that. That's definitely like making, you know, lemonade from lemons. It's like you have a challenging experience, and then you go, I can work with challenging personalities.
Or I don't shy away from strong personalities. How's that?
That's perfect.
The person who had brought the Stat Center to Seattle had also been a lung committee statistician for 20-something years, and he was also doing myeloma, and he was ready to lessen what was on his plate because also being the director of the Statistical Center was a lot of work. And so we transitioned the committee to me.
And what was his name?
John Crowley.
Yeah, nice guy.
Super amazing person.
And, okay, so there you go. You're like a brand new, wet behind the ears assistant professor with a big personality. And you're thrown into this kind of cooperative group mix of like really big name, big personality, big thinkers from across the country.
Yeah.
And what was it like?
I mean, the nice thing was, is that there was definitely overlap between, so I mean, I was just learning a lot from John. So at first, you know, we would be on calls and I would just sort of see what he was doing, but he was pretty happy. Basically, I'd worked with big personalities and I did what I always do, which was approach things where learn about what people want to do, ask lots of questions, do my own work, and I'm not shy, so I had no problem with talking to people. And the biggest challenge working with a group like SWOG is that everybody's all over the place and you don't see each other in person a whole lot. And that's why, like, the group meetings, which we have every 6 months or so twice a year, are so important, because then you start having the people's faces and voices and everything together. And so it takes about, I think in any job, but this in particular, it took about 2 years to get to where I just kind of, I felt like I knew what I was doing more than before, but it was fun. I mean, I liked it from the start.
What were people asking you to do? So what is it, this gets into, you know, what does a biostatistician do in SWOG?
SWOG's business is doing clinical trials. And so I'm biostatistician / clinical trialist. And so it was designing single arm phase 2 trials, randomized phase 2 trials.
You know, again, let's assume our audience is intelligent, but, you know, possibly ignorant about the details of stats and the role here. So I'm a clinician and I can say, okay, to answer this question, I want to do this clinical trial. And, mm-hmm. you know, why do I need a Dr. Redmond at that point?
Oh, that's a good question, right? I mean, because you really do.
You will. I know. It's like an. It's like a need more than a want, you know.
Well, you've done this conversation with me where we start talking about, okay, you have a drug or drug, some drug regimen that you want to evaluate. Let's suppose there, so the first thing that we start talking about is, so what's known about this compound or therapy? How's it been studied before? Is there phase one data? Are there, what's the reason why we think this drug is going to work? And then we also talk about what the population is. Who are we wanting to test this therapy in? And so we start working down that path, and you say, okay, well, there's some phase one data. There's some signal of activity somewhere, but what we really need to do is do a phase two study because with like you and I figuring it out that we're not ready for the phase three, not the definitive evaluation. We've got some information on dose and toxicities, and now we need to see if there's a signal of activity to continue studying the drug. So if we've had that conversation and that's where we get to, and then we talk about, well, what's the mechanism of action of the drug? Like, how do you expect it to work? Well, okay, if it's something that's going to result in tumor shrinkage, then we think maybe response would be a good endpoint to measure activity. If there's something else where we think, well, maybe prolongation of time to progression would be a better way to assess it. So we'd start thinking through, based on the like the disease, the mechanism of action of the drug, how we're going to assess the activity of the drug, say in a phase two. And then once we start thinking about that, it's like, okay, then I start thinking about what type of study design would make sense for this. All the while, we need to talk about, well, what's the size of the population? What's a reasonable number of patients that we could enroll? If it's a super rare disease or a rare biomarker, I'm not going to design a study that assumes that we're going to get, 10 patients a month onto the trial, right? No matter how many institutions you have. So feasibility concerns always come in, and we always have to be thinking about, well, what's going to be reasonable there? And then it's also, well, how quickly do we want to answer this question? Is how quickly is the science happening? I mean, if the field is moving really quickly and we want to answer this question in 2 years, then we better design a study that can be answered in 2 years. If we have more leisure to be able to take longer, then we might do that. So all of those things, and I'll say, well, maybe a single arm study or a randomized phase two study. Do we want to incorporate a biomarker because we think that there might be a biomarker that could be suggestive of the patients that are most likely to benefit? Do we want to incorporate the biomarker in the design in some way? So we just start working through, once we complete this trial, what's going to be the next step? Because we want to set ourselves up to have answered the question, signal of activity in this example, that would move on to a phase three. And what that would look like, or even if we don't get a good answer, if we don't have a positive signal, we want a study that's definitively answered the question that it doesn't work, or we can use it for further study. So it's the way that I think that particularly, mathematicians, statisticians are trained to think logically to just sort of go through the different steps about what you're trying to answer. And I find medical doctors and lab-based scientists as well, they're like, you're really good at like putting together all the understanding of the biological mechanisms and the patients and the drugs and everything. But the way that your brains work isn't perhaps in the same structured way about how I think problem solve. So together, we come up with something that's, I think, a really, I'm like, I can't do it on my own because I don't have the knowledge, but you don't necessarily have the knowledge of like, let's think through the best way to answer the question. And independent of all of that, I just think it's always good. The scientific method is to discuss and work together and question why you want to do something a certain way so that the end product is a better product.
Yeah, I mean, on a simplistic level, you know, is it a 10 patient study or a 30 patient study or a 50 patient study? And that's the easiest bit to understand where the statistician comes in, because you go back to what we talked about how precise do you want your measurement to be. And so, like, the more precise, the more numbers you have to beat, because that point is going to be a little skinnier. Whereas if you're kind of like, it's somewhere between, you know, here and the whole bunch over there, I can get away with a smaller number of patients.
The most of the time I spend doing that. I mean, that's the, it's not like just running numbers. It's the conversation and thinking through. And then I might do simulations or other things to think about the properties of a design. So I might do some thinking on my own and then come back and discuss it. And then once we have a design and then we write up the protocol and I write the statistical considerations that describe exactly how all of the data will be analyzed and how it'll all work. And I also look at other parts of the protocol. And then we send it to the NCI and they tell us that we're wrong and we have to completely redo it. But, you know.
It's, you know, management by committees, but, you know.
Yes.
So one of the things I want to make sure we get to is, you know, one of your real successes in SWOG, which is the Lung Master Protocol, which is inappropriately abbreviated MAP, which doesn't actually, isn't it?
I don't, no, it's like MA from Master Protocol. Yeah, I don't.
Okay, tell me about when did you first hear about the Lung Master Protocol and then when did you grab the reins of it?
The Lung Master Protocol, Lung MAP, was open to accrual in June of 2014. In March of 2013, we had the kickoff meeting where we met with various like FDA, NCI, industry partners and had the, you know, this is what we're planning on doing. We had no drugs yet. We just had the concept of the design.
So do you want to explain what even were the concepts at that point?
The concept was that when you have rarer biomarkers, that screening thousands of patients to get, you know, 5 or 10 patients onto a study is not very efficient. And in particular, an aggressive disease setting, we had chosen second-line squamous lung cancer. So this is a setting where median survival was 8 months. We should be building upon the non-squamous field where there had been discoveries around targeted therapies. So you had EGFR, ALK, et cetera, and that the way to move forward squamous cell treatment was to look at targeted therapies within biomarker-defined populations. Aggressive disease setting. And so in order to actually move this forward, and I think that in many ways they learned from the BATTLE trial that you needed an infrastructure to make it even feasible to do these small targeted therapy population studies. And so the idea behind a master protocol is to develop an infrastructure so that you can conduct multiple targeted therapy biomarker-driven studies at the same time. And at the same time, that genomic screening wasn't standard of care in this population, so we needed to be able to actually offer screening of patients' tumor tissue to determine if they had a biomarker to go onto a targeted therapy study. And so what LungMap did was it established common biomarker profiling for all patients that wanted to participate. And then the goal was to have a study for everybody. And so we had, our idea was that we wanted to have at least 4 or 5 biomarker-driven studies going on at the same time. And then a study we called the non-match trial for patients who weren't eligible to go on to one of those biomarker-driven studies. So that you enroll, you're still going to have to wait like 2 weeks to get your biomarker results back. But we assign you to a trial. There's at least one for you, and then you can move on. And that it was designed to be modular so that as study questions were completed, those studies would close, but we could continue to add new studies in.
Was there a concept of a common control arm, or am I getting confused?
There was an idea of that, but...
Can we explain what that means?
Common control would basically mean that you'd have one control arm across multiple targeted therapy or biomarker populations. Or if you had multiple targeted therapies within a biomarker-defined population, that maybe you could test those against the same control arm. Partly because of that we run our studies through the National Cancer Institute, but also just logistically anyway, it's actually harder to do that with what we have.
Okay, because my understanding was the idea was like, say, I'm going to do the test. If you have marker A, you get treated with this, B, you get treated with that. And then everyone else went into this thing who was just going to get, I think, some kind of chemotherapy, and that was going to be your control. which sounds terribly attractive. You know, not everyone has to be randomized in every situation, you know, the other people. Although I can see a challenge with it, because if you're pre-selecting people not to have a marker, you have a different group of people than going into your first buckets.
So that's exactly the problem, is that you don't have a comparable care. So the, you know, if a marker, if they behave differently with standard of care, you're not going to be able to infer that. So that's really why we've just generally done like direct randomized studies that have direct comparisons. The non-match study for patients who don't have a matching biomarker has pretty much always been randomized as well.
Oh, got it. Okay.
Yeah.
And so,
answer your question, like, so we did our kickoff meeting in March of 2013. I think the first time that I ever heard the concept, and the concept was presented to us within a SWOG, at a SWOG group meeting. I can't remember if it was in Chicago or San Francisco, by Valley.
Valley Papadimitriakopoulou.
Papadimitriakopoulou.
Yes, that's a shibboleth in the world of thoracic oncology. Let's see if you can pronounce your last name.
Well, because the Kupulu, they all have the same vowel sound.
You have to say that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Kupulu.
Kupulu. I think it was perhaps even in 2011 that she first presented the idea to us. And then in February of 2012, there was a meeting that was jointly organized by the Thoracic Malignancy Steering Committee, the FDA, NCI, that the whole point was about accelerating drug-targeted therapy, drug development, and what could we do. And the outcome of that meeting was that we needed to do something like a master protocol.
Yeah, and I mean, for me, you know, there are high points and low points. I mean, one of the, I think, strengths of it is bringing clinical trials to community sites who are involved in the cooperative groups.
Yeah.
And allowing people to enroll in those trials. So do you know how many people have been enrolled in LungMAP so far?
So in the screening portion of LungMAP, over 5,000. In terms of sub-studies, I think we're close to 1,000.
Wow. And it's still ongoing. 10 years later, it's still ongoing. It's morphed a little bit, but it's still ongoing.
Yes. So we initially were in second line squamous cell lung cancer, and that was what we opened with in June of 2014. In January of 2019, we launched what I like to call LungMAP 2.0, where we expanded to allow both squamous and non-squamous, so all histologic types of non-small cell lung cancer. We also moved away from doing studies that were looking at immunotherapy naive populations and focusing on patients who'd already received immunotherapy and could we overcome resistance to prior immunotherapy. And the new LungMAP, the major change up until now, we have required either patients to have tissue submitted for on-study next-generation sequencing testing through Foundation Medicine, or if they'd already had Foundation 1 done, they could submit a request to have their results reanalyzed and provided to us. But you know better than me that a lot of patients are getting next-gen sequencing as part of their routine care, and they don't necessarily use Foundation 1. I mean, there's a whole lot of other vendors that are doing that. And what we are moving to is allowing patients to use their previous NGS test results to participate in LungMAP.
Well, that's good. I think the, you know, democratization of clinical research is certainly one of the strengths of LungMAP. We've also talked about how, despite, you know, the incredible strengths of going into it and the statistical design, you're still at the mercy of the science. You know, the drugs either work or they don't work, or the biomarker works or they don't work.
Yep.
My issue with LungMAP is sometimes the whole efficiency of getting it open, even though it's actually pretty efficient with the modular structure, still sometimes there's just either repeating things that we already know about or that we already know work, which is great, or things that we already know don't work. But I'm not sure there's any solution to that.
So, and I would say that the real challenge there is not LungMAP as much as it's finding, we have to find interesting study questions, but part of it is that the way that drug development has accelerated, and industry kind of likes to run the studies themselves. So it's finding the drugs with an industry partner that is willing to give up some of the control and let us run the studies versus them running the studies. And what I'll tell you is that when it comes to the timelines about opening studies, we're very efficient. The thing that delays us most of the time is contracting.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's usually things like, you know, intellectual property. It's like, well, who's going to own the breakthrough? And it's like, oh, you know, lawyers get involved.
The patients do. Let's let them own it.
You put them at the center of the equation. That's brilliant. Yeah. So you've been doing LongMap for over 10 years by the sound of it.
Yeah.
Are you planning, you know, to drift into retirement on the coattails of LongMap, or are you planning to do something else in the future?
Yes.
The yes was not an answer. It was an imprecise answer.
I answer that way because, I mean, it's actually something that I've been thinking about lately. I mean, I love what I've been doing, and I mean building LongMap and fostering that, and so much that I learned about what a master protocol is and how I got to shape how we do them was really great for me. I would like a new challenge, and so if that can happen within LongMap or within what I'm doing, that would be great. But if a different opportunity came up, I might take that. And so, if anyone who's doing math knows that I started at the Fred Hutch in 2005. So next June, I'll have been at the Hutch for 20 years. And so I don't quite know. It could be that something, I have a new chapter, or I just have, you know, my next chapter uses just different ink. I haven't decided yet.
Well, that was a good analogy. I like that one.
Thank you.
We've already talked about your professional future. What about your personal future?
My personal future. Well,
yeah, you as a person.
Me as a person. Well, I already have some really great trips planned. I'm going on a bike trip in Chile in December. And then I'm going to go walk the Kumano Kodo in May.
Where's that?
It's in Japan.
Wow.
Ancient pilgrimage route. I mean, I'm not doing the whole thing, but I'll be doing a good portion of it with some time in Kyoto. And yeah, I mean, the personal future is there's always an option for fun new things, but I like to travel. I like to ski. I like to bike. I like to play my flute. I like to cook. I mean, there are all of those things can have different things that I choose to do.
I love it. Mary, thank you so much for sharing your time with us. I hope we get to interact again in the future soon.
Thank you so much, Ross.
You've been listening to How This Is Building Me with me, Ross Kamage. Rate us and review us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, or follow us at DR Kamage on X for additional commentary.